I would like to welcome up both Aaron Houston and Bill Piper at this time. Am I right? They are here?
They were here. I saw them.
They may have stepped out for a second. We'll work that out. Let me go ahead and tell you a couple of things about the two of them. They both, for those of us who've lived and worked in Washington on this issue for a number of years, we all become friends because it's a fairly small community of people until recently that focused on legalizing marijuana. And certainly Aaron Houston and Bill Piper have been two of the major players during that time. Let me start just with Aaron. Aaron currently is the lobbyist here in town for Ghost Group. Now, if you don't know Ghost Group, they're actually the people behind both Weed Maps and Marijuana.com and some other projects around the country. Justin Hartfield, a member of our board of directors, in fact, is the person who runs Ghost Group. But before that, in the capacity where we knew him, he was for, let me see how long here, almost 5 years, he was the director of government relations for MPP, Marijuana Policy Project. For a year and a half before that, he was also their field director, doing the kind of work that Kevin does for us now. In addition, he was, for 3.5 years, he was executive director of Students for a Sensible Drug Policy. So Aaron is both very polished lobbyist, knows Congress, knows how to do the job, and has had hands-on experience now for, I guess that gives him something like over 10 years on this issue here in Washington, D.C. Bill Piper, who just joined us up front, most of you will know him because he's been the Drug Policy Alliance's in the Office of National Affairs. He's director of the Office of National Affairs. His responsibilities include developing and implementing strategies for ending the federal war on drugs. He lobbies Congress in support of cutting drug war waste, protecting state marijuana laws from federal interference, reforming draconian sentencing laws, restructuring federal law enforcement agency, and preventing drug overdoses and the spread of HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C. As Alan mentioned, the Drug Policy Alliance puts on a semiannual conference once every 2 years, and they're in Washington, D.C. this November, and it certainly is probably the most prominent drug law reform conference in the country, and we urge you all to attend. Bill, would you like to go first today? If you have a preference, I don't care.
Yeah, it really doesn't matter. We could try to give you guys some time and we could speak a little bit and tell some stories, some that probably include you too, Keith, actually.
and also you're welcome to take questions from the audience.
That's what we were
obviously
hoping to do. Yeah, maybe leave some
and
time.
And by the way, you may either stand up here or sit there, depending
okay,
on
thank
your
you.
Preference.
I'm probably comfortable here.
Yeah, I'm
thank
comfortable
you.
Just
thank
saying.
You. Appreciate it. One funny story I actually thought about. So just encapsulating this a little bit and sort of, you know, bringing it into some context, we're in a very different world than we used to be, right? And we all know that at this point, but the world has changed and it's changed very rapidly, and the political environment has changed very rapidly as well. And so having had, you know, a front row seat to that, as has Alan and as has Keith, it's been an incredible honor and privilege just to see the evolution of the issue and the evolution of public officials taking a stance on it, more people speaking out, more people becoming part of the marijuana majority speaking out, saying it's time for reform. And, you know, we've seen that most of all. I was thinking on the way here of, like, you know, we're looking for some, give some practical lobbying tips, but I think one of the best practical lobbying tips I can give you relates to just not overestimating, and I'll just tell a quick story, maybe give it to Piper, not overestimating the average either intelligence or education level of a member of Congress, because, you know, these guys are making the laws, and these folks are making the laws. And obviously, we all want to believe that they're doing that in an informed fashion, but I have some really bad news for you if you believe that. They're not. And in fact, one of the funniest stories that I remember, and I don't, you know, I really don't think the congressman would mind me mentioning his name now at this point, years later. But
do not associate me with this.
Well, we were with a congressman. We're trying to get him to do a legalization bill years ago, and Keith was in the room too. And the congressman said, he said, "So how much should we legalize? You know, what, like 10, 13 pounds?" And we're like, "No, that's way too much. That's never gonna fly." And he just had, he literally had, and this is one of our like strongest allies.
And this was for personal possession.
possession. So he just had no idea what an incredible quantity of weed that would be such an incredible quantity of cannabis for personal consumption, which is cool. Like, I want 10 to 13 pounds for personal consumption. It's just thinking about what might fly with fellow members of Congress that probably wouldn't fly. But he just had no clue what that was, you know, so what kind of volume that was. So I had a congressman years ago, a Republican congressman, ask me if what we were talking about, medical marijuana, I was referring to, he said, "Are you referring to the pill?" And I said, are you talking about Marinol, Congressman? He said, "Yeah, is that what you're talking about?" I said, "No, I'm talking about botanical cannabis sativa L. It's a plant that grows on a huge portion of the earth's surface." You know, but I had to say that with the straightest face possible and not in a shaming way, because I didn't want him to feel ashamed. So that's probably the number one piece of advice I can give you, is don't overestimate what these folks know, either the staffers or the members of Congress. Also keep in mind that you're an expert on this. So that is something that you should always remember as you're going into these offices, that you have something valuable to offer them. Keep in mind as well, you know, a lot of what has held us back in the past is the stigma around talking about it, right? So keep in mind that when you're going into conservative, especially conservative, Democratic, and Republican offices, you may be talking to a staffer who perfectly well knows what dabs are, or perfectly well knows what a no-spill bubbler is, or a bong. But he doesn't want to be the guy in his office to tell his old boss what, you know, a dab is. So it might be a very uncomfortable conversation for that staffer to even demonstrate any knowledge at all of the peculiarities or the technicalities of consuming marijuana. So that there are a lot of dynamics at play there, and keep that in mind as you go in, and try to be gentle with them, and try to just genuinely take their questions at face value and try to answer them best you can. So, yeah, Piper, you were in that meeting with the 13 pound. Keith, I told without naming anybody the 13 pounds of weed story when we were trying to get the decrim bill introduced. 13 pounds.
Well, let me first start with some very relevant breaking news, which is that Senator Daines, Republican from Montana, is going to offer an amendment tomorrow in committee. The Veterans Medical Marijuana Amendment that nearly passed the House, we lost by two votes. He's going to offer that tomorrow to the Military Construction Veterans Appropriations Bill. We think we can win this, because we only need, if we got all the Democrats, we only need one Republican, and he's one Republican. But we assume we're going to lose Feinstein, so we need at least two Republicans. So I don't have the list on me, but if you're tomorrow during your lobby day, if you're meeting with anyone who sits on the Senate Appropriations Committee, it's worth asking them to vote for the Daines Amendment that they'll be voting on that day. You know, I've been doing lobbying on drug policy reform for 15 years. Marijuana legalization, passing sterile syringes, overdose prevention, decriminalizing all drugs, you know, not just marijuana, but cocaine, heroin. And so I just want to give a little tips that I have found useful. If you read, and I actually didn't read what Normal put for their congressional, their general how to lobby, but, you know, a lot of how to lobby sheets that you can get off the internet, you know, will encourage you to dress up and be as business oriented as possible. I generally think that's good advice, but I also think you should be comfortable. So go with what makes you feel comfortable. I think that's especially the case if you're lobbying as a constituent, because you're just a normal person. And I want to echo what Aaron said about, you know, not putting, not assuming that members of Congress are experts, but you should, you know, not assume they're on some sort of pedestal either. They really are ordinary people, and their staffers are ordinary people. And so, you know, I don't know how many of people in this room have done any lobbying before, but if you have any fear, do not be afraid, because they love meeting with people, especially their constituents, and it's pretty easy. The flip side of them not being an expert, I agree with Aaron that you're the experts, but you're not the expert on everything. And we're not the expert on everything, and I don't think there's anyone out there who's an expert on everything. That same member of Congress who wanted to legalize 13 pounds actually thought he was an expert on everything, that's an exception. So, you know, I always encourage people to never be afraid to say you don't know the answer to something, because there's nothing worse than saying something that's not true or 50% true or 90% true, because once you lose their confidence, it's gone. So if you don't know, just say, I don't know, I'll find out, I'll get back to you. And that's actually really useful as a follow-up anyways. And I use that a lot, even in cases in which I do know, but in which I don't want to go into detail, or I recognize I'm not the right person. So if I'm talking to a staffer and they're like, well, isn't heroin instantly addictive? I could be like, well, no, actually, it's not. There's a lot of studies that show otherwise. I'll get those studies to you. I could go into detail if I wanted to, but they're not really going to pay attention to me. I'd much rather give them studies from a scientist. So I don't know. Perfectly legitimate to say if you don't know. And it's also legitimate to say even if you do know, because it, you know, following up is a really good thing. Which gives me to my next point. To the extent you can do, if you're meeting with a staffer, and developing a relationship with them, to the extent you can do their job for them, that's great. If you can get them research, if you can get them talking points, they will take all of that, they will put their name on it, they will give it to their boss. That's perfectly fine. That's actually what we want them to do. And, you know, part of that has to do with, you have to understand that staffers work very long hours. They work on dozens and dozens of issues. They can't possibly be an expert on any one issue. Who doesn't want someone to help them do their job? So, you know, following up, providing information, very useful. I have a motto I think it's always worth keeping in mind, which is leave no legislator behind. No matter how awful you think this person is, even if this person is a total asshole, do not give up hope. Because what we have found is two things. One, people do change over time, and we're starting to see that, especially on marijuana. People who are voting no, 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 no. Some of them are now voting yes. But also, even people who generally vote no, it's rare that they vote the wrong way all the time. You might get them 1 out of 10 times, and that 10th time can make a difference. And so there's a lot of issues in which we have won on. It was a close vote, and some of the yes votes were people who historically voted against us on other issues. So never, you know, hold your members accountable. Don't be afraid, hold them, accountable. If you're inclined to work, to get them out of office, that's fine as well. But try to keep as cordial a relationship as possible with them and never give up. And I'll just give, two examples of this. One I'll name and the other I won't. So Chairman Grassley, Chuck Grassley from Iowa, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, has been an opponent of drug policy reform for years. He's been the author or co-sponsor of a lot of really bad bills. If there's something bad going on in the Senate that's drug-related, it's usually him and Senator Feinstein. And he's come around. on some issues. So he's come around on asset forfeiture reform, for instance, in which he's leading a charge to reform civil asset forfeiture, where the police can take your property without convicting you of a crime. He has talked recently about removing obstacles to research for medical marijuana, and is essentially in a war of letters with the Justice Department and HHS. It would not surprise me if he ends up holding a hearing on marijuana and obstacles to research, if not this year, then next year. He really is starting to come around. And then on like sentencing reform, you know, this is an example of, you know, the not giving up. He has consistently said, I'm not going to support sentencing reform. I'm not going to support it. I'm not going to support it. Now he's saying, I'm not going to stand in the way. For those who work on like mandatory minimum reform, et cetera, there's a very good chance we can reform sentences this year. He's been the main obstacle. He realizes he's the main obstacle. We've gotten, and when I say we, I don't mean just mean a Drug Policy Alliance, there's a whole coalition of groups working on this. We've gotten other Republicans to weigh in with him to say, stop being an obstacle. We've gotten press in his state highlighting how he's the obstacle. So he's probably going to allow a vote. He'll probably vote no, but that's okay, because we have the votes on the committee and we'll win. There's another member of Congress, in terms of not leaving a legislator behind, who always voted the wrong way on marijuana, in committee hearings, always said the wrong things. We never could get through really to his staff, so I took Ethan in. Ethan Edelman, our executive director, Ethan and I went in, and we talked to him, and he was not at all courteous to us. This is my imitation of him. Yeah, to everything we said. And we were talking about medical marijuana, so it's not like we were even that radical. And at one point he said, you can bring Montel Williams in here, and he can cry all up in this place. I'm still not voting for medical marijuana. We brought Montel Williams into his office, and Montel did cry all up in that place. And he still voted no, consistently. But the last couple of years, he has voted yes on medical marijuana every time it has come to the floor. And I don't know if he has really seen a light on medical marijuana. I don't know if it's because the politics have changed in his district and in his state. I don't know if it's because he's a Democrat and like 95% of Democrats are now voting the right way and he doesn't want to be embarrassed. I don't know. I don't care. All I know is that he's voting the right way, and we never gave up on him. Ever. Like every year when the Hinchey-Roybacher Amendment came up and we looked at the list of Democrats that voted no, and Aaron can attest to this, the groups working on this issue, we knew the swing votes, we knew the no votes that we hoped someday would flip yes, and we always talked to them year after year after year, and a lot of them have come around. Some of them still haven't, but I think that they will. Few other notes.
Can I quickly jump in, Piper?
So
I was going to say, for people to be aware that we actually have these votes coming up, in addition to the Senate vote that Piper mentioned, we have a number of votes coming up on various appropriations bills in the coming, basically in the coming 60 days. On the Justice Department spending bill, which is called the Commerce, Justice, Science Appropriations Bill. And that will have the medical marijuana and then possibly some other amendments on that bill. You know, one thing, just to follow up on what you were saying, Piper, but I think that's excellent advice, leaving no legislator behind, leaving no statesman or politician behind. A perfect example of this, and I know that you've seen this phenomenon as well, Piper, is, you know, Republican congressmen who are dead set against medical marijuana because they believe that it's somehow distasteful, that it's that it diminishes the practice of medicine somehow, that it's sort of insulting to their intelligence because they know that people who are not desperately ill may be accessing medical marijuana. And you talk to those same Republican congressmen and say, well, what about letting a state decide its own policies? And I say, well, I might be for that. You know, I mean, you're talking to a conservative Republican from Texas. So that is a perfect example where you would think it would seem to follow for most of us that, well, if the person doesn't support medical, they're probably not going to support legalization. Well, that actually may not be true. Maybe they will actually support a federal policy that lets their own states decide, and maybe they'll even oppose their own state law their own state marijuana law and yet protect the state's ability to do that, which is actually really important. That's really what we need at this point. So I just to highlight and underscore that point is critically important. And that's why, even if you hear something that may sound and may be patently offensive, such as none of these people are sick, you know, medical marijuana patients are not sick, that's, you know, objectively offensive, and it makes you want to explain in a, you know, a really disappointed and angry tone to the staffer why they're being an idiot, and why that's absolutely wrong. That's the wrong strategy, right? In this instance, you can explain, you can choose to fight the battle or not, explain the science, but you can also move on to the next thing. You can say, I see that we might disagree on that. What about letting states decide their own policies? You know, so there are ways to move into those things in graceful ways, and that's what these guys are used to as well. It's a constant negotiation. And my strategy in any conversation I have with a member of Congress is, particularly the members themselves and the senators, I don't want to leave that conversation unless we found something to agree on. And we can pretty much always find something to agree on, whether it's government waste or, you know, too many burn grant dollars going into the DOJ's programs that are mainly arresting low-level drug offenders at the local level. You know, we can find something to agree on before that conversation ends if we have a few minutes.
Yeah. Which gives me, I think, to my final point, and maybe we could take some questions, which, you know, and I don't know how often people meet with their members of Congress or how active people are, but I always encourage people, if you're inclined to work on issues other than marijuana, that's a good thing. Like, one of the things that I have found very useful over the years is we've developed relationships with offices on other issues other than marijuana. So we've worked with offices on sentencing reform and overdose prevention and asset forfeiture reform, et cetera. And then when we've come back in on marijuana and been like, and, you know, framed marijuana as a civil rights issue or a public health issue, a kind of a light bulb goes off. And it's kind of the same thing with some offices and states' rights, that if you're states' rights or limited government or libertarian-oriented and developing those relationships with Republican members of Congress, you can slip the marijuana in. And it's also good for coalition building. You know, one of the useful things, Initiative 71 in D.C., which legalized marijuana, which Congress is, you know, basically trying to overturn, like, the coalition around that is a very strong coalition of groups that are united in a single principle that Congress should leave D.C. alone. Because marijuana is not the only issue that that Congress is messing with D.C. on. They're messing with us on reproductive rights, on guns, on abortion, and a few other issues. And so we've put together a pretty good coalition of groups. And some of those groups don't care about marijuana. Some of them even oppose marijuana legalization, but they're committed to the principle that Congress should leave D.C. alone. And so building these alliances, I think, are important. And I think that's one reason why, and I'll just, you know, I have the luxury that, you know, not only do I have the luxury of working full-time on these issues, but I have the luxury of working not just on marijuana, but broader issues. But I always like to make a strong plug to be careful not to throw other folks under the bus. You know, to not make arguments like, instead of focusing on marijuana, let's focus on cocaine and heroin, because those are still nonviolent offenders and they shouldn't be in jail either. And I think it's unethical to make that argument, but it's also strategically not good, because when you need those groups, and there are groups, harm reduction groups that stand up for the rights of injection drug users, to side with you, they're going to be less inclined. It's the same thing with, like, oh, don't focus on drugs, focus on immigration. Well, you know, good luck trying to get groups that work on immigration to side with you on your battle. And so that doesn't mean don't take every, obviously everyone has all sorts of positions on all sorts of different issues and you should be yourself. But to the extent that you can build coalitions and not unnecessarily sell other people down the river, it goes a long way on the Hill, and it goes, and offices remember this stuff. They definitely remember, you know, you worked our bill on mandatory minimum reform. So, you know, we're going to listen to you and you suggest that we co-sponsor this bill on marijuana legalization.
And yeah, I think to underscore that point, I think that there are ways to get at talking about other drugs and enforcement with other drugs without being undermining of the drugs themselves or the users thereof. For example, one way to, I think, constructively discuss one of the most powerful talking points and indeed one of the most powerful just points of evidence I have seen as an advocate recently is last August's JAMA article, a study showing that it's a Journal of the American Medical Association showing that in states with effective medical marijuana laws, which means, to be clear, that there was an access point that people could actually access the medicine in a retail fashion or some sort of fashion in an accessible way, there was a 25% lower fatality rate for overdoses, opioid overdoses, which includes both, I think included both injection heroin and also any opioid, I believe. So that's, that's an amazing statistic, a 25% reduction in a study of tens of thousands of cases. It's based on CDC data. NIDA has their own take on what that means. The administration has their own take on the study, and they don't detract from it exactly, but they say that there are some limitations to the study that they're not sure exactly that it's correct, but they would like it to be studied further. But at the very least, it was in the American Medical Association's journal. So that is, I think it's a great piece of evidence to point to if you want to bring up other drugs, talking about that study in particular. I guess, should we take questions at this point?
Yeah, we should.
Yeah, okay. Well, so that was the Commerce, Justice, Science Appropriations Bill, and that's going to, and that is, I'm not sure if that's on your sheet or not, sorry, Piper, that's going to be coming up, that's going to be an amendment, it's going to be voted on, it's one of the few, these medical marijuana amendments, anybody heard everybody in this room knows that medical marijuana amendment passed Congress last year, became enacted as part of the spending bill. So it's in federal law right now for the first time ever. The words medical marijuana appeared in the federal statutes, public laws this year. As a result of that, our coalition is bringing that amendment back. These appropriations bills, because of the House rules, allow us a unique opportunity to get amendments and votes on these amendments. So the reason that we've done these amendments over time on these spending bills only is because they're the only bills under basically for constitutional reasons and House rules reasons, they're the only bills that allow an open amendment process. So because Congress is so dysfunctional and because it's hard as a minority to get votes on bills and measures, this has been the only avenue available to our side for a very long time. And it's often, these are the bills where you often see activists, members of Congress, bringing up a slew of different amendments. On a particularly hot topic like guns or something like that, abortion rights as well. In this case, we've got at least four amendments probably coming up this summer, so we will have at least four more votes. We had one vote on the VA amendment that failed by two votes several weeks ago. And that was really unfortunate because actually the two members of Congress, two of the people we expected to vote yes, one of them accidentally pressed the no button, and the other didn't feel the measure went far enough, so he voted no on it. So we would have actually won that VA vote several weeks ago if not for that kind of happenstance, that chance.
Every year these votes are coming up.
And the rest of the legislation you see on your list, that's actually introduced what's called authorizing legislation as opposed to appropriations legislation. There are two types of bills, basically, the authorization and the appropriations, the money for what's already been authorized.
And I'll just add, it's also just easy to say to folks that there's going to be a bunch of amendments this year designed to let states set their own marijuana policy, and the members of Congress should support those amendments, because yeah, there's going to be probably several more, including just to reemphasize the Daines Amendment, that if you, I'm pretty sure this was in a packet that everyone got, the normal congressional guide. The Senate, which is the blue, Appropriations Committee, if you're meeting with any of those senators tomorrow, tell them to vote for the Daines Veterans Medical Marijuana Amendment, because that's going to be voted on tomorrow. But just generally speaking, it's also just useful to say vote for the right for states to set their own marijuana policy. And also almost all of these bills that Normal has highlighted also would do that. So letting states set their own marijuana policy is a very good talking point.
Anybody from Alaska here by chance? All right. No. Yeah.
No.
Thank you. That's a great question. It's a great question. So you find your way to the office in the House office building complex, one of the House office buildings. It'll either be the Rayburn building, the Longworth building, if we're talking about the House, the Rayburn building, the Longworth building, or the Cannon building. And you'll wend your way through these cavernous hallways until you get to the number door you're looking for. And it's just a big wooden door. It's very heavy, actually, so you might have to give it a little bit of a push. And oftentimes the doors will be open, but a lot of times the offices will also close the doors. You just peek your head inside, and usually there will be an intern or some office worker right there to greet you. And you just say that you have a meeting with whoever it is in the office you're meeting with, that you're expected to meet with, and they'll probably either ask you to take a seat. Oftentimes they won't ask you to take a seat because there's literally nowhere to sit. And they will either come and sit with you in that little spot if it's really busy inside the member of Congress's office. If it's not and the member of Congress is out or voting or something like that, then they may actually take you into the member of Congress's office, which is pretty cool. You get to see the actual office of the congressperson you're visiting, even if you don't get to see the congressperson themselves. And oftentimes, Mitch, these are really just, they're one-sided conversations a lot of the time. It is you kind of giving your presentation and giving a quick spiel, keeping it as brief and explanatory as possible, is my strong recommendation. Trying to have a very kind of brief introductory pitch where you talk about why you've come here. And the way I like to do this is obviously you want to get the facts out there, but it's also important to tell stories if you can. And if you have personal stories, and especially stories from your district, stories about people in your district who have been affected by marijuana laws, then that's, or even stories that you know of, that is an effective way to get people's attention. That's an effective way to get anyone's attention. There's a lot of time later, as Bill was talking about, to follow up and send the statistics and the white papers and stuff like that. I also try to make sure I ask if they have any questions, and if there are any areas that they would like me to cover. Because oftentimes if I just say, do you have any questions, they'll say, well, no. If I make a little more of a specific ask and say, is there anything I didn't talk about here that you're curious about? That tends to be, a little bit better than just the generic, or, do you have any questions about this that I might answer while I'm here, about the topic? I'd be happy to delve into it if there's anything that's unclear about what I said or anything else here. So that you can expect that they'll take, about 10 or 15 minutes at the maximum, and they'll take, a few notes. But don't be surprised if there's not too much engagement or questioning from their side, because they're, as Piper said, they're busy. They're dealing with a lot of different issues, and this is one of 50 or 20 or 50 issues they have to look at in one day.
Aaron, also, in case there are people who haven't made an appointment,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's best, you know, it's best if you can, if there, it's, you would have plenty of time today. If you know, if you haven't set an appointment yet with a member of Congress, who's planning on participating tomorrow, by the way, who's planning on, that's great. Fantastic. You guys, that's wonderful. If you haven't yet made an appointment with a member of Congress or members of Congress you're looking to talk to, and the senators you're looking to talk with, you should call them today. Just call the staffer today and say, I'm in town tomorrow. I'd like to meet with you. Is there a time that we could meet? And if you've already sent an email and they haven't gotten back to you, it's certainly appropriate to follow up with a call. You could also email. I would recommend, the ideal would be to email and then call later today sometime. But you could also, you know, you can drop in. It's best if you ask them if they have some, you know, at some point during the day, some bit of time to talk with you for 5 minutes.
Another thing I would add is just on, since you brought up the issue of spacing and where people are, like, don't be surprised if you meet in a hallway or in a very crowded room with other people, because there's a lack of space and there are a million lobbyists in the office at the same time as you. And then, you know, just keep in mind, this is especially the case as constituents, like, you know, they, I'm not going to say they necessarily care what you have to say, because sometimes they don't. But they do have to listen to what you say, and they take constituents very, very seriously. And no matter what you say or how the staffer reacts, that stuff does get written down. And in some cases, it's transmitted directly to a member of Congress. In some cases, they put it into a database and kind of write up the notes. But the important thing is that don't feel in any way intimidated. Like, we live in a democracy. It's your right to meet with your member of Congress or their staff. And people do this every day. And this is especially the case as coming in as a constituent who they represent. They will give you a lot more leeway than they will give me or Aaron, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm.
And also, if you happen to recognize by face any of, basically any member of Congress, I was going to say any of the non-famous ones, but like...
You're the only person who memorizes congressional faces.
if you do happen to recognize members of Congress, and you call them by name, they will love you because they'll think that they're really famous. It's really actually true. So if you can even just, if you don't know what your congressperson looks like, look in the guide and look at the photo and maybe do a quick Google search in case the person has not changed their photo recently. do a quick Google search and see what they look like. It's a helpful tactic, I promise. It really works
Aaron,
well.
What's the honorific for somebody in Congress?
Congressman, Congresswoman.
Congressman.
Yeah.
I guess a question about leveraging private conversations in my particular case, it's Dr. Brad Winstrup, congressman from the 2nd District of Ohio. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So he's told you directly.
I interact with him as much as I can back at home base. Mm-hmm. I've never actually visited his office.
I think you're probably going to talk to a staff member.
Yeah.
So I think saying to that staff member, relaying that to the staff member, that's perfectly appropriate. Yeah.
In fact, they sends back, you know, don't even read the letters that you wrote.
Sure, sure. Right. Yeah, that's a common thing. I mean, we see that, and those stock letters, as I'm sure you guys all know, you know, those have failed to evolve with the times.
I mean, I agree with Aaron about raising that and pointing out to the staffer that you had a conversation with multiple conversations in which he said X, Y, and Z. Because in a lot of cases, staff members actually don't necessarily even know where the member of Congress stands, and they make assumptions that aren't necessarily true. Also very useful for them to know that you've had conversations.
Right.
So I would raise that, and then I would point out that there will be votes. In fact, I would actually see how he voted on the Veterans Amendment. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. point out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's worth finding out if he voted yes or no on that. And then also just letting him know that, you know, in the old days, they used to be able to get away with saying, oh, well, I don't know. If this comes up for a vote, I guess we'll find out. But no, there's going to be votes. In fact, there already was a vote. And if he was around last year, there were like 5 votes last year. Offhand, I just don't know.
Yeah, he didn't. I don't know. I think he voted no.
Yeah, he voted.
Yeah. Oh, if he voted no, then yeah, you should call him out, especially if his voting record is not matching up with what he is saying mm-hmm. privately.
I think I saw your hand first.
Who in the office and the liaison situation, who would you ask for to deal with?
Thank you. That's a great question. You want to ask for the LA. It's short for legislative assistant. The LA who handles marijuana. Very simply ask for the person in the office who handles marijuana. You can just simply ask for the staffer in the office who handles marijuana. Just say a big thank you.
Yeah.
Just give him a high five. Yeah. Yeah. and encourage him and tell him that you'd love to see some amendments messing with the DEA.
Yeah, you can never think there was a Congress
yeah,
enough when
yeah,
you do the
totally.
The right thing.
Sir, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Me?
Yes, you.
Aaron Bill. My name is Kelly Anez. I'm out of the Orange County, California Normal Chapter.
Hey.
What's unique, valuable, and challenging to this? I heard both of you say what's unique to me is you don't want to use cannabis vernacular that make a staffer demonstrate knowledge about the cannabis industry. Bill, you said they love meeting with congressmen. Congressmen are just ordinary people. What's valuable is, Bill, you said they love meeting with people. Aaron, you said we're the experts on this topic. What my question is, what have you seen that's been challenging for a rookie lobbyist like me on a lobby day, if there is any visible challenges you've seen?
It would be going on too long.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. That it's a common mistake. It's just the most common mistake by far. I mean, would you say so, Piper? And more than that, not knowing kind of what to edit, like what things to hone in on. Okay. I think that's the real skill of it, is like, when you get that pushback on medical, for example, like at what point do you just shut up about medical and shift to let's find a place where we agree, you know?
And that's a strategic choice, because I mean, you may want to make your stand your ground on medical. I think the important thing is, one, they don't have a lot of time, and so you don't want to waste it. They're not going to remember 95% probably of what you say. And you're there basically to get a very clear point across, co-sponsor this, vote for this, whatever, and develop a relationship. Like, you don't need to educate them on every marijuana issue or even one marijuana issue completely, because you're not gonna, no one could do that. And even if you gave them an hour lecture, I trust me, they will not remember it. So, you know, your focus is a relationship. So it'd be like almost as if you met someone, I guess, like at a coffee shop, and you were talking about marijuana. It's like you're kind of chit-chatting, except you have a point. And you might not necessarily have a point at the coffee shop. But, you know, you don't. It's this is not the place to give, like, a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
That is one rookie mistake. And the other thing I would say, one challenge is, you know, don't give up and don't get frustrated. One of the things I find challenging is especially the case when you're meeting with more junior staff, the younger staff, is what I call shark face, where their eyes roll back because they're not even really listening to what you're saying. They have completely checked out, and it can be very, very frustrating and depressing, but it's still important to get your point across. And that's even more reason to make sure what you're saying is short. and salad. Like, you want the clear takeaway to be, I'm a constituent, this is important to me, and you should co-sponsor this, because, you know, the staffer may not care about marijuana issues. They may care about marijuana issues. My experience is that staffers think approximately 2 to 12 hours ahead. That's their life. Mm-hmm. They're, what is on the floor today? What are people calling? Why are the phones ringing today? Holy crap, that article was in the front page of our hometown newspaper. What are we going to do about that? So they're easily distractible, and they're working on 75 issues, and they try to think long term, but they really can't think that far ahead.
And that's part of why our jobs are challenging, because I mean, we've got a meeting on the Hill on Friday, for example, to prepare for all of these upcoming votes. But it's like pulling teeth to get these guys to think, you know. And part of why we've been so successful, I think, in the last couple of years, is that we've started having a lot more proactive planning ahead. I mean, a lot more strategizing and in an intentional way with members of Congress engaged in that process. It's not just, you know, not just us lobbyists working on it anymore, you know, constantly trying to get the members of Congress to do that. They're now engaged in that process and having meetings months and months out. But it's really hard to get them to focus, you know, more than a day ahead. I think I saw Paul's hand a while back.
Yeah, Aaron, Bill, I just had sort of a general question for people in the audience. I'm assuming that a lot of people here are familiar with the polls, particularly on medical, but on some of these other issues where they're very favorable polls, and then the disconnect between the support that's seen in the polls and then oftentimes the political support. And I was wondering if you could speak to your experience. To what degree, when someone's meeting with a member of Congress, ought they to bring up polls, when particularly if they have local polls specific to their state that are favorable to what they're advocating for, and what the response sometimes is that they receive if they're speaking with a member of Congress, say from Pennsylvania, where you see strong support at the state level in Pennsylvania, and you're a member of Congress who's essentially disregarding the poll. And I was wondering if you'd walk people through how to handle that conversation, or if they should leave with that, those sort of polls, or if that puts the congressperson on the defense.
So, I don't know, Aaron might disagree. It's a very good question and a subject of debate, I think, among lobbyists. I don't like to cite polls. I don't think members of Congress or their staff believe polls, especially on our issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, we spent years pointing out that 80% of voters support medical marijuana, and none of them believed us.
And that was a Time magazine poll.
Yeah, and it was like poll after poll, and you could show, oh, it's not just nationally, it's in your state. What they do believe is, oh, voters passed this in their state, and the legislature passed this, and the local NAACP supports this, or the local ACLU, or the local Americans for Prosperity, or you know, whatever the local groups are that might be. And like, I think that is much more meaningful, because one, that's what they ultimately care about, is not getting booted out of office. And you know, an 80% poll doesn't mean you can. There's lots of issues in which 80% of voters say one thing and members of Congress do another, and they know they're never going to lose their election over it. So I don't think that they necessarily even care about polls, but I also don't think that they believe it. People have a hard time comprehending things that conflict with their... This is a whole other issue, but you know, be careful about challenging people's worldviews too much, because they were shut down. And that's not just members of Congress. That's no one likes a worldview challenged. And so I think when you come in and say 80% support this, and that's not what they know, because that's not what they see or hear. Now, they're living in a bubble. In fact, we all actually live in a bubble, our friends and our family and what we watch on television. We've gotten to a point where we actually choose which bubble we want to live in. It's kind of nice, actually, but it has its downside. So I'm sorry, that was a very long answer. But you know, I think it's fine mentioning polls. I just wouldn't go into too much depth. And if you can cite things other than polls, such as what voters have done, what legislators have done, what other constituents have done, parents with babies that have seizures, or overdose, parents who've lost people to overdose, like whatever, like something personal or politically relevant, that'll be the poll hands down.
Yeah, I'd say I pretty much agree with that, because I there's a functional problem too, Paul, I think, in the sense that there are so many polls out there. I mean, it's just illustrating how a tipping point we're at this point, but that there are so many polls out there at this moment, it would be hard to edit which one to which one to share, unless you have one that is directly, I think, from the state and you're talking to a senator. That would be a relevant thing to do. But if you're talking to a member of Congress, say from Pennsylvania, and you have a statewide poll, Pennsylvania is a large enough state that it's not particularly representative of that person's district. And this is what we've gotten year after year. The only time I really saw members of Congress pay close attention to the polling we brought them was when my former organization dropped, I think it was about $75,000 on polling in different districts of targeted members of Congress to ask, if this member of Congress were to vote for medical marijuana, would you be more or less likely to vote for that person? And I think we also asked about base level support for medical marijuana. And those polls were effective. Those were good. But I think we could only afford to do them for like 7 members of Congress or something like that. So.
What's the value of the resolutions by city council back in their home district?
Oh, I think city councils in a home district would be very, very effective. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally.
Do you think this?
Yeah,
editorials, yeah. From newspapers?
Sure. Yeah.
News articles, I think that stuff probably matters much more. They live in fear that they're going to be booted out of office.
And social media has fueled that. So if you guys, if you have a good meeting with a member of Congress, and you're on, how many people are on Twitter here? Users of Twitter? Wonderful. That's great. If you have a good meeting with a member of Congress, you should tweet that you had a great meeting and say thank you at so-and-so for that wonderful meeting. You listen to our concerns and think, or thank you for your support on medical marijuana. Great meeting today with at blah, 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 right? So they love that, because that, like, they're engaging most of the time with their tweets. They're just engaging out. They're just pushing stuff out. It's rare that anybody, is nerdy enough to actually tag a member of Congress and say, like, thank you for this. So.
Maybe one more question, if there is. Yes.
Thank you. Kind of dual-pronged question, but we wanted to lobby our senators and our district congressperson. Do we lobby other members of Congress not from our district? Still from our home state, though.
I think if you have some connection to the district, then maybe, but you should be aware that you may not be welcomed as warmly as you would be if you were a constituent.
Yeah, it helps if you have a connection, like you work in a district but live in a different district,
or you grew up in that district,
or you grew up in that district, or if it's you have something relevant, if you're like a scientist, or if you're working on a ballot initiative that's going to be statewide or something like that. But generally speaking, they don't really care what non-constituents have to say, unless you're representing something, like if you're representing an advocacy group, I'll just, before you give us the cane, if you are involved in any, if you're representing like a normal chapter or any membership group that has members, very worth noting that and citing, like, if you have membership roles. If you represent 1,000 people, say you represent 1,000 people, that's always helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, folks, I think it's obvious that these are two pros. You can see why they've been leading the charge for many years here in Washington. Thank you both for your insightful comments.
Thank you. Thank you.